Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drower, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts Incorporated v. Goldsmith, which was argued before the court on October 12th. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Zvi Rosen, an assistant professor at the Southern Illinois University School of Law, who has written extensively on the development of modern copyright and trademark law, as well as on bankruptcy law. I'll hand things over to Professor Rosen to talk about the case.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Probably the most consequential fair use case of at least the past 30 or so years, 29 years, for those who are counting. I will note, yes, that it was an interesting argument, and as you're seeing the future of the Supreme Court argument process, perhaps, where the argument was for almost 2 hours, even though it was only allotted for 70 minutes, with the justices being called on sequentially. Also, the court only let 19 people in from a lawyer line, generally seems to be limiting much more attendance in person, which I thought was interesting. I'll tell you a little bit, though, about this case. Warhol, first being the Andy Warhol Foundation for Visual Arts versus Lynn Goldsmith and her licensing agency, which licenses photographs. So first, I'll talk a little bit about the photo. In 1981, Lynn Goldsmith got the assignment to take a picture of the artist Prince, then still fairly early in his career. And she wanted to capture what she thought his vulnerability and shyness. She took this picture in 1981. She only took a few shots of him before he left early. All that was fine and well. Lynn Goldsmith is an accomplished photographer, especially with a lot of rock and roll, among other work, and has an extensive licensing business. So this entered a stable of her copyrights. All fine and well. A couple of years later, 1984, Prince's star had really risen, and Vanity Fair wanted to do an article about how he had become a major celebrity and also some of the unease associated with that. So we had an article called, and so they said, we need an illustration of this. They bought a license from Goldsmith to use this photograph as an artist reference. Unbeknownst to Goldsmith, but within the terms of a license, they then hired Andy Warhol to do a Warhol version of this, which he did. It was published in 1984 with an article called Purple Fame, around the time of the movie Purple Rain, of course. This was near the end of Warhol's life. He died in 1986. But unbeknownst to certainly Goldsmith, Warhol created 15 other similar drawings of Prince, the so-called Prince Collection, or Prince Series, rather. And these were within Warhol's property. Warhol died in 86. These were all subsequently sold off to private collectors for large amounts of money. Even that didn't bring the lawsuit. Goldsmith was apparently unaware of these uses of Prince's, of her photo to create the Prince series. That all changed in 2016 when Prince died. Condé Nast wanted to run a special commemorative issue, and they requested permission to have the purple Warhol that was used in 84. Now, I will note, of course, I believe Vanity Fair is a Condé Nast publication, but nonetheless, they realized they needed a license to print it. The Andy Warhol Foundation said, just so you know, we have 15 others in our collection of copyrights. Would you like to use a different one? And they instead used the orange prints, which is a prince. Warhol found out about this use, and that began this lawsuit. Now, everyone agrees. So the Warhol Foundation was paid $10,000 in 2016 for this. Goldsmith was paid nothing. Everyone agrees that this is fundamentally a copy, not just obviously based on, but literally you can see Warhol used the photograph as part of the silkscreen process to create the whole Prince theory. So it's not simply inspired by, it's literally copied from the photograph. Question then becomes, is this a fair use? And so the lineage of fair use goes back to really the 1830s. And I should say, I wrote an amicus brief in this case, I focused on some of the early history of fair use and also the derivative work right, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Section 107 of the copyright law says that use of a copyrighted work for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research, however, those are only exemplary, you see, for instance, such as a keyword there as well, is not infringement of copyright. And then the statute sets forth these four factors. These are not exclusive factors. Notice factors shall include the purpose and character of the use, the nature of a copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole, and the effective use upon a potential market for a copyrighted work. And you have a few cases that start interpreting this, but the key one really is Campbell versus Dickhoff Rose Music. The case happened in 93, where you have the use of Roy Orbison's song Pretty Woman, and then the rap group Two Live Crew created effectively a vulgarized version of that for their album As Clean As They Want To Be. Ironically created mainly because Walmart would not run their main album As Dirty As They Want To Be. The Acuff Rose Music, which I believe was Orbison's publisher, sued Campbell et al., saying it was copyright infringement. The U.S. Supreme Court held that the use by Campbell was fair use because it was parodic. In particular, they said the key thing about a parody is that it has to use the entire work in order for its essential message of parody to be understood, and that the court would look at whether there is a transformative meaning or message to the use. So as happens perhaps all too often with Supreme Court opinions, courts saw this language and may have over-applied it. That's certainly what Zoltzman is saying. But parody is one thing, but regular uses are another. And there are a series of cases in the Second Circuit, notably Carey versus Prince, a different Prince, which stretched the meaning of transformative use and the meaning or message test. The district court thus applied the Carey case and held that because the use by Warhol conveyed a different meaning or message than the Goldsmith photograph, it was a fair use. The Second Circuit disagreed. The Second Circuit said Carey had been what they called the high watermark of the extension of fair use, and they said, no, it doesn't go quite that far. Transformation is an important consideration as part of a purpose and character of the use, but it can't be the alpha and omega of a copyright inquiry. And so as a result, the court found for Warhol. Now, I will say, after the Second Circuit held, the Second Circuit held for Goldsmith, the district court held for Warhol. After a Second Circuit opinion, the Supreme Court held the Google versus Orzel case, holding Google's use of the Java programming language was a transformative use. Warhol went back to the Second Circuit and asked that they reconsider their judgment in light of new precedent, but the court stayed where it was. They added a new section to the opinion saying that the Google case is really about software, not about IP, not about transformative use generally. And interestingly, I didn't see a lot of mentions of Google versus the article at the Supreme Court, which I found rather interesting. It was only last term and found the work to be transformative, but it's a very different sort of usage. So never before the Supreme Court, the question presented is whether the Supreme Court was right to use an objective test, as they put it, as opposed to a meaning or message test. The real question before the Supreme Court is what weight to give transformation and the meaning, whether the work communicates a new meaning or message. I do think there's a general sense that some of the cases that just said, is there a new meaning or message, good, fair use, are going to be overruled. And we're going to see a new standard, which narrows fair use some, but probably not in a way which is necessarily going to make Goldsmith happy. So I don't necessarily know how it's going to go. I will say also, the actual question presented only looks at the first aspect of a fair use factor, the purpose and character of the use, and whether or not it's transformative. The other factors, which the Second Circuit held also favored Goldsmith, may well not be addressed by the Supreme Court. You had a long discussion of whether they were even briefed, and counsel for Warhol said they were not. So I'd be surprised if you have complete use, a fair use. I think you're probably going to have a remand with a new standard for transformation and how to apply it. After which, I kind of suspect Goldsmith will probably win because she won all the other factors, but I'm not sure. So one of the key questions here is, what use exactly are we talking about? And part of that is, how do we define works and uses? In other words, when we talk about a fair use, are we talking about the creation of a new work that's a fair use? Or are we talking about each individual use of a work? And some people have argued that it looks to whether or not a work is a fair use and it's done. I think that's difficult if you look at factor four, which is really specific on the effect of the use upon a potential market. It's difficult to know necessarily upon the creation of the alleged infringing work. But at the same time, if every time you create a work that's fair use, you have to rerun the fair use factors, at least people argue that's going to be a major drag on the creation of creative uses. On the other hand, of course, you can easily imagine that not saying that fair use and reapply to each use leads to absurd results. And for instance, going back to Pretty Woman, let's say you just wanted to be opening guitar riff, which I believe is the same in Campbell's use. If you, pretty obviously, you can't sample the Campbell song to get a recording of the opening guitar riff from Pretty Woman, even though it's the same thing. Pretty clearly, you'd have to go back to the original because you aren't using the transformative work for a transformative purpose. But how exactly that means is going to vary, and the court is going to have to look at that. Another interesting question is, how exactly is a meaning or message test for transformation related to derivative works? And this is where we get into an interesting question of what exactly a derivative work is. Generally speaking, the copyright law gives a series of exclusive rights. It's a right to make reproductions, make distributions, performances, and to create derivative works. Derivative works, for instance, are a dramatization, a sequel, a translation, a supplementary work, etc. And in terms of how a meaning or message, there's a lot of concern if a meaning or message test really eviscerates the exclusive right to create derivative works. In particular, if you list 17 U.S.C. 101, the definition of derivative work is a work which alters, recasts, or transforms the original work. And so if your test for fair use is whether or not it transforms, but you have, and I will say transform does not appear in the statute, but whereas you do have a statutorily defined right to create derivative works, where the word transformed is used, you'd think that there would be a preference to follow the statute and to say that transformative works are works which one cannot create unless they are otherwise in fair use. And it's frankly going to be a real tightrope. It doesn't help, by the way, that we still, even though we have this definition of, you know, works that, you know, adapts, transforms, or recasts the original work, we don't really have great definitions of what derivative works are. There's not a lot of cases that explain how something called substantial similarity, aka non-literal copying, is different from exclusive right of fair use. And even in legislative history, is not that helpful. There are some cases that try to define it, but the definitions are generally insufficient. The case that tried to say, well, if it's a new medium, it's a derivative work, but they're derivative works like sequels, which are in the same medium. So it doesn't seem to fly. It's some really interesting questions from the court about whether purpose and character of the use are the same thing. See that in factor one, the purpose and character of the use. And sure, copyright lawyers have generally read these terms as being almost sort of a magic phrase. and not read them separately. But the Supreme Court was saying, well, maybe we should look at them separately. And clearly speaking, the purpose was not transformative, but was the character transformative? And splitting those words to look at two different things, which would in turn put transformative use more in the character of the use rather than the purpose of the use. That, like I said, that, as far as I know, has not really been discussed among copyright lawyers. It'd be interesting to see if that gains traction. Another practical question the court was really looking at is what sort of evidence is there for meaning or message, and how would you figure it out? I mean, this really gets to the concern of making judges into art critics. That's been a concern for a very long time. Famously, have a Blessing versus Donaldson lithographic case in 1903, where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. made very clear that a judge on copyrighted work should not assign themselves a judge of quality of the work, only whether or not it's being copied. And that was very much repeated in Campbell versus Acuff Rose. So, but you're de facto gonna be asking question of, as Campbell says, you have to know if it's a parody or not. Judge has to make the determination. But there's a real concern that by making judges the determinants of meaning or message, we're making the judicial role too large and adding too much uncertainty to the case. You had an interesting mention, of course, going back to Warhol, of whether Warhol's use of Campbell's soup cans is a fair use or not. And the question, he could have made Cheerios boxes, for instance, would that have conveyed the same meaning? And I think as many people noted, the soup cans are an easier case for fair use because he was using them in a profoundly different sort of way than was being used in, you know, by Campbell. Campbell wants to sell used soup. It's a sort of trademark-like use, although they are copyrightable. Warhol had no interest in that. He was simply commenting on commercialism in the era. But you do see this sort of desire to have a standard for the use of the original, because you have this line, criticism or comment. And the lawyers for Warhol tried to argue there's no necessity that you comment on the original. That's an interesting argument. It's been argued before, but you know, it goes to that sort of parody satire distinction that comes out of Campbell to a degree, although courts have sort of blown past it. To find that a parody is a fair use because it necessarily uses the original that comments on it. A satire which merely appropriates the original but does not comment on it is not a fair use. It's not necessary to take the original little in the whole. Many courts have gone beyond that to say that more general satire is also a fair use. Warhol's counsel argued that. Goldsmith's counsel obviously did not. And you did have a government which argued for itself, and which fell down in his brief and argued as well as the parties, did suggest a standard if the use of the original was necessary or either useful or highly useful. I saw some dithering that word highly. But generally speaking, that there is some real utility to the use of the original, which made it important to use the original and not merely a choice. It meant the classic example of just, you know, if you look at something like Weird Al songs, some of them comment on the original song. Some just appropriate the song to make some sort of left-hand joke. So if there was some concern, American Society of Media Photographers filed a brief that said, if you go with Warhol's interpretation, it's going to be essentially impossible for commercial photographers to make a living, and a lot of concern about that. But there are some broader questions here. In the Supreme Court in 1883, held that photographs are copyrightable, but not everyone has fully made their peace with that. And you did see some people trying to argue about photos. I don't think the Supreme Court will touch that. But I got a question, you know, questions about whether photos are in any way different because they attempt to depict reality. They depict reality in a more sort of concrete way or not. I don't know if that will play into it or not. Also have had a fascinating conversation. As I mentioned, argument went nearly 2 hours, and Chief Justice Roberts was actually calling on the justices. So Justice Thomas, as is usually not his wont, spoke. He mentioned he was a fan of Prince in the 80s, leaving Justice Kagan to note and not anymore, which got some laughs from the audience. And he had this example: what if you took the Goldsmiths, took the Warhol, and you painted it the purple Warhol and painted it orange, and set it up at a Syracuse game, you know, a Syracuse Orange Man, of course, and whether or not that would be a fair use. And truth be told, this is really anyone's guess what's going to happen, but it's going to be enormously consequential. Fair use is the main and increasingly and really by far the most important exception to copyright law. And it's all over the internet, people saying they're fair users or not. And I do think you're going, whatever happens is going to be very important.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.